All right, so here's the deal. Things are changing fast in the tech world and the internet marketing world. And that's a big deal because you have to know which trends to stay on top of in order to market better, in order to acquire customers for cheap, and so you can run your business as efficiently as possible. Staying on top of all those trends is a pain in the butt, though. And so the folks at HubSpot have made this amazing report. It has a very official sounding name because it is a very official document. It's the 2024 State of Marketing Report. They've looked at millions, tens of millions of bits of data to find the top marketing trends that have the most immediate impact on your business. And so what HubSpot did was they surveyed over 1,400 marketing pros from across the world, and they looked at what are people using effectively, what's not working, more importantly, and they've been able to compile it in a really easy to read document. So if you want to learn ways how to optimize for social or how to boost engagement or how to strike the right balance between privacy but still being personal with your customers, go to HubSpot.com/state of marketing to get the free copy, or just Google HubSpot State of Marketing and it will come up. Check it out.
All right, what's up, everybody? It's July. The whole world is locked down or not locked down. We don't know what the hell's going on, but me and Sam just recorded this episode. We talked about a bunch of things. We talked about a project that one of the podcast listeners has launched, an erotic newsletter that's doing $6,000 a month very quickly, and I think he built the project in about a month. We talked about this crazy thing called GPT-3, which is this AI project that came out of OpenAI that everybody's losing their mind about. We talk about BNI, this old school business referral network. And then we talked a lot about, Sam asked me a bunch of questions about life at a big company, which we're not sure if it's interesting or not. So I think we're going to put it at the end of the episode. We're going to chop the episode out of order. We're going to toss that at the end. Maybe it's not interesting. Maybe it's interesting. It's up to you guys to decide. All right. Hope you enjoy this episode. As always, let's do it.
Boom. All right, what's going on?
Dude, I had like a perfect day yesterday. I did everything that I'm supposed to do, which is great. Like perfect in that my actions were perfect. So I feel good.
And where you are, I'm obsessed with weather. Where you are, high of 82 today, currently 72. You have nice Californian weather.
I was just outside. I take all my calls by the pool. It feels fucking great. It's excellent. Can't complain.
So in San Francisco has been horrible weather lately. It's currently 60 degrees. So it's been like 60 and cloudy the past week. Do you think you're happier with the sun?
For sure. Yeah, for sure. Greenery and the sun. I'm a human. I think that works on humans.
So my wife is from Manhattan. Like her mom and dad live in like the heart of Manhattan. And she's trying to convince me to move to New York. And here's the pros and cons. The cons are New York's pretty like objectively horrible weather. Like okay. At least 9 months of the year, it's just like cold and like kind of wet and gray.
Yep.
And then taxes suck. And then like it's fairly dirty.
Right.
And crowded. And the pros are like you're like if you're in the hustle and bustle, it can make you more ambitious and it can be inspiring, but also wear you out. But so my question is, where you've moved out to, there's way less people. It's more space. Do you think that the risk of getting fat and soft is worth the being happy with space and weather?
Yes, given where I'm at. If I was 24, I'd be like, yo, this is not the right move. In fact, when I was 23, 24, I was living a sweet life in Australia. And Australia is like sunny. You go to the beach. People don't work that hard. Everyone in the country basically has a truce. Like, yo, I won't work hard if you don't work hard. And we'll all stay, you know, at the top. And I was like, I got to get the fuck out of here. Like, I'm definitely going to become less ambitious, less motivated. I'm going to become less of a person because I'm not going to challenge myself if I stay here. I'll be so comfortable. But now where I'm at, 32 years old, sideburns all gray, you know, got a kid, got a wife, got a dog. For now, that slow down pace and being less in the hustle and bustle and having experienced it, I'm good. I'm ready for that next chapter now. So this is, I feel good about it. But then again, I'm human and we just justify whatever the fuck we do anyway. So, but I believe it. I don't think I'm talking myself into a bad decision. I think I'm in a good decision here, especially now that everything's online, dude. I actually believe this. Silicon Valley is on Twitter. Like Silicon Valley moved to Twitter some number of years ago, and like San Francisco, you know, South Bay, New York, London, it doesn't matter. Twitter is where the heart of the action is actually. You can build a world-class network on Twitter. You can get access to great conversations. You can see ideas and get, you know, become a part of them. You can raise money through, you know, through the internet. Twitter is Silicon Valley. I'm pretty convinced of it.
Yeah, I agree. I've been getting sick of it lately. I'm like, I don't want to, it's been getting a little, what's it called?
You can stick to Twitter?
Homogenous. Yeah. So I'm having to like follow different stuff. I watched the, this TV show where the Ford versus Ferrari thing, and they were in like racing cars. And I was like, this is way cooler than the internet. I need to surround myself with these people.
Dude, I had a moment like that where yesterday I was listening to, I opened up Clubhouse, that app that's like still in beta, I think.
Yeah, I quit using it out of principle.
It was like, you know, the notification was like, Mark Andreessen is talking to, you know, whoever, you know, a bunch of people. And so I was like, oh, Mark Andreessen's on. I went in and they were talking about like, if an asteroid was coming to the Earth, what would be our mitigation strategy? And then it's like, you know, they had all looked into it. And I was like, who looks into this? You know, they look into this like I look into conspiracy theories and like I look into the drama behind MTV's The Challenge. So, you know, they were like, oh, yeah, I've read about what we would do and here's what would happen. And then I like happened to like kind of swipe and just like miss, like, I like switched apps into Twitter. And then at the top of my feed was the guy from Barstool, Dave, doing a watermelon eating challenge against this kid. And I was like, yeah, I'm going to watch this instead. And I was just like opted into like the mindless entertainment of that. And no regrets in that choice. That was the right choice for me.
And so I agree. A similar topic. Have you seen the TV show Peaky Blinders?
I actually started it. I watched 15 seconds of it. I haven't gotten into it. I watched yesterday. I started it.
So I love that show and I love Boardwalk Empire. And I started rewatching Peaky Blinders from the beginning. And the for anyone listening, it's fiction, historical fiction. So it's mostly fake, but supposed to be based on real stuff. But I don't,
it's like a crime family or a mafia or something.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. So they just like, it's this guy, Thomas Shelby, and he has this family of five or six family members. And they start out mostly illegal. So gambling, selling liquor, fighting, betting, just like your traditional 1920 gangster.
Story of me and your life. Yes.
Yeah. Then they get a little bit legit, but they're always still kind of doing bad stuff. They just drink and smoke and fuck and fight and just all bad stuff. Just not bad stuff, but love vices. And I was like, this guy's way cooler than like Mark Zuckerberg. Like, let's just like
Mark Zuckerberg on his surfboard with his white face and huge ass.
Yes. I'm like, dude, this guy's a rock and roll star. Whereas like,
Mark Zuckerberg wouldn't survive a day in Peaky Blinders.
Right. But, you know, who knows? Maybe. I mean, he's pretty gangster, but in a dork way. But right. It was just like, I need to figure out who I look up to.
Yeah. That's a good point. You are who you admire. And like, you know, whatever. No judgment. They just go through phases. And I think both you and I are in a phase where it's like, or at least I'll speak for myself. I went like pretty deep on the admiring the people who did great things in tech and startups and kind of modern day business. And I know you shifted to like, fuck modern day, historical business is where it's at. Historical pioneers and settlers and shit like that, generals. And then, but it's cool to admire different things, but not get stuck in the admiration. And so, I don't know. It's a good question to ask yourself, who do I admire right now? And then should I stay admiring them or do I need to switch it up?
Well, and also I read a lot of personal finance stuff. So I read a lot of subreddits around personal finance stuff. And some of it, it's like people who have high net worths and how they're doing personal finance. And they're like buying a $3 million home and they're like making all these justifications or buying a fancy car. And every once in a while, I'm like, the only justification for me doing this is because it's fucking cool. And since like, we need to remember that, doing something just because it's cool is oftentimes a wonderful reason why you should do anything. And it's a life worth living. And like, cool. I get too caught up in like, well, you know, if I annualize this out over 15 years, like it's
right.
Like it would be cheaper. IRR? Yeah. And I'm like, oh yeah. But also like rock and roll, like let's just do stuff just cause it's awesome. That's just, it just makes me happy.
There's, You know, people say, like, you know, what advice would you give to the 21-year-old self? And, like, I ask that question, too, to when we have guests on here. If you were 21 again, what would you do? There's all this, like, what would you tell your younger you? But also, good question is, what would 12-year-old you or 21-year-old you say to you now? If 18-year-old me or 21-year-old me came out of a time machine and got to see 32-year-old me, what would he say? He'd be like, dude, you got fat. What's up with that? Like, yeah, this is all cool, but, like, you got fat.
Aren't you getting fit, though?
I'm getting fit, but, like, to 18-year-old me or 21-year-old me, this would be fat. And he'd be like, wow, that's lame. Or it'd be like, dude, you're a millionaire? Like, okay, what are we doing with all this money? What is the cool shit we're doing? Like, are we going here? Are we gambling? Are we taking our friends on trips? And it's like, oh, you're buying equities? Like, all right, well, like, you know, so I actually like the other way. I want in some ways, 20-year-old, it's like, I think forward 20 years and I think backwards 20 years. Would 21-year-old me be proud of the way I'm living my life? And then would 51-year-old me be proud of the way I'm living my life? And these thought experiments help me make these adjustments and get out of the fog of, like, just the routines that I'm in. Because these routines are really fucking dangerous.
I agree with all of that. And I think it's good questions to ask. I find myself asking that stuff all the time of, like, it's so easy to get caught into this optimization type of mentality. This is what I told, we had a meeting today at my company. I was like, you guys, less optimizing, more innovating. Like, let's just do cool shit and not, like, worry as much about the click-through rates.
Right.
Well, you want to bring up BNI?
Yeah. So, okay. Two topics. Actually, I want to start with a different acronym, GPT-3.
Yeah. I've been talking to Sam about it and I've gotten access.
Oh, nice. Okay, great. So give people the simple explanation, Sam, simple explanation.
Ah, man, there's a lot going on. Let's make it really simple, do you remember Smarter Child when you were a kid? That AIM bot where you could ask it the weather and you could ask it, like, is God real? And it would come up with, like, things. It's like that on steroids. So from my understanding, it's an AI tool where you can use, a lot of people are using this thing. So the guy who was the leader of Y Combinator quit Y Combinator to become the CEO of this. And it's basically this, I think Elon Musk is considered a founder as well. It's basically this engine where you could tell this AI bot to do stuff and they do it. For example, someone's like, create a website where there's the Google logo and a search engine, and somehow this bot, like, turns it into a search engine and it just so happens to look like Google.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't even know what GPT stands for. So that's how much I know about this. But basically, you feed it little inputs of text, but you can also feed it actually images they've shown as well. But most people, what they're doing with it right now, they feed it small snippets of text. So for example, somebody can feed it a snippet of you can just ask a question and it'll answer, like Smarter Child. Then there's a website called learnfromanyone, I think.com. Someone built a little tool, which is you pick who you want to learn from. So you can be like Einstein, and you can ask a physics question and it'll answer based on what Einstein would say to this. And it's, like, shockingly good. And so you can kind of, like, pick a teacher and then ask a question, and then you can get an answer from that teacher based off of whatever that teacher had put out into the public domain that this algorithm has ingested all this, like, raw text from the internet, and through it has found, okay, what would this person say? And so there's all these crazy use cases, like you said. Like, I have a friend, Sharif, who's the guy, his tweet went viral where he basically was like, just described what he wanted a web page to be and had spit out the HTML code or the JavaScript code to build that site. So he was like, make a to-do list where I can add a to-do and then I can mark a to-do as done. And then it actually built an app that was a to-do list app just off of that description.
That was your buddy?
Yeah. And he did the Google one too, where he's like, put the Google logo up top and then add a search bar and add two buttons. One says search, one says I'm feeling lucky. And then return the answer to whatever question is asked in the search bar. And he built, like, a Google competitor. It spit out a Google competitor.
So, but let's talk about, like, real. Like, do you think that this is actually going to be legit?
We all know that AI is pretty transformative technology. It's going to be whenever AI, you know, as AI progresses, it'll be the next big tech shift. You know, the previous tech shifts were from, non-computers to computers, computers to the internet, from the internet to smartphones, and now it's smartphones to AI. And that AI is either really narrow, like it can only do a specific set of things, which is like when you see an AI beat the best Go player or chess players or poker players in the world. That's very narrow. It can only do that one thing. Or if you said, okay, this AI is going to identify faces, and it's like, cool, facial recognition. That's a narrow AI. This seems a lot more general. And the more general AI gets, the more exciting things are, because that means it can do a lot of different stuff that you can't really predict. And the kind of, if you want to get real futuristic and crazy, general AI, or AGI as they call it, is considered the last invention, the last human invention that will ever be needed. Because once you have AGI, then AGI invents everything else.
What, like, I think I'm a little bit of a normal, like a pretty normal basic ass person when I think, well, this is just like the end of everything I ever believe in. Right?
Believe in meaning what? Like, I don't know what's man-made versus created by a robot.
There are, what is the point of a human being? Like, we exist to do work, I think. Like, we exist to, like, do stuff. And if this thing is doing everything, then what are we supposed to do?
We're going to consume it, and we're going to become entertainers and podcasters and artists. And we're going to, if you take the long view, when this gets really, really good, we're all just going to be playing video games and making art.
Okay. This thing can definitely do that already. Like, but do you think it's actually good?
You mean, is that a good outcome?
No. Do you think that this technology is good at enough? Yeah. Or is it still pretty basic and overhyped?
It's not good enough, but it is shockingly good. Like when you're like, oh, it's like when you see your niece after like 3 months and they had a growth spurt and you're like, whoa, like you're up to, wait, last time you were came up to my hip and now you're like eye level with me somehow or whatever. Like now you're up to my shoulder. Like that's crazy. You're still not a full grown adult, but like, damn, I didn't realize you grew this much. That's what happened with this project is there was a, damn, I didn't realize it was this good. Where like, holy shit, these conversations seem very human-like. Somebody put in like the first half of their blog post about how to run a board meeting, and then it spit out the second half and finished the blog post about how to run a startup board meeting. I was like, wait, how does it know that? How does it know what I would write in my blog post? It was like kind of indistinguishable, the first half and the second half. And the first half was written by a real VC, and the second half was written by the robot who was just basically guessing what the next word should be, which is like kind of insane.
I almost want this to fail. Like, I'm like nervous.
That's not going to happen. Yeah, that's the best inventions. They always say like the best technology seems like magic. And when you see real magic or you see magic, you're like a little bit scared. Like when you see David Blaine do some crazy shit, you're like, whoa, hold on. What's going on here? How did the card end up in my boxers? Like, that doesn't make any sense. That's kind of how this feels. It's a little bit scary.
So, but that's my question. Do you think that what your buddy did, do you think that it's actually good? Or do you think it's like, do you think that it's still like a car in 1930?
It's still like a car in 1930. And I don't know what those cars are like. But basically, in a sandbox, if you can control the inputs and you can kind of play around with it, you can demonstrate, you can create really cool demos, really cool even prototypes. We're not at products yet. But we'll get there. Like this GPT-3 is improving on GPT-2. So it's like, fuck, how good is 4 going to be? And 5? Like, it's like, you know, the original iPhone really wasn't that great either. And then now it's like, I watch movies on my phone and, you know, like it's amazing. And like things get amazing pretty quick. And so I think this is going to get amazing pretty quick.
I'm a little in awe. So I've applied to get access, and I've talked to Sam about it, and he was like, "Yeah, the person who gives access is on vacation for like 2 or 3 days, but they'll get back to you." I'm like, "All right, well, I guess I'm waiting on her to reply." But I want to use it for writing articles on the Hustle.
Yeah, I was gonna say you guys should write the news through a robot one day. You know, basically like one day a week and just see what happens.
Well, that's what So I'm waiting to get access for that. We'll see.
I wanted to run our transcripts for our podcast through it. I basically just wanted to be like, hey, it's Sean and Sam talking. What would we say if we talked about X? And I bet it could recreate our, you know, stupid conversations.
Well, can't you ask your buddy to set that up?
Yeah, I can. I just got to talk. So I'm going to bring him on. So next week, I want to do a segment where I'm going to bring on the guy who built that thing, as well as either Furkan, who's kind of my trusted tech, like, you know, a sounding board, because he's also realistic. He doesn't get caught up in the hype. And then there's also this VC at Founders Fund who wants to come on and talk about it. And so
who? The young guy?
Dillian, yeah.
I don't know him. Yeah.
He's kind of a troll on Twitter.
Good. I like that. Well, I'm curious to learn more. I just feel like I'm not smart enough or educated enough to actually know what's legit and what's not. And I want to know, like with your buddy, was it as simple as you literally just type into Google Doc and you tell this thing what to do and it does it? Or does it require more? Is there more stuff to it?
Yeah, we'll ask him. So yeah, we're noobs, but we know enough to know that, hey, this is interesting. This is worth understanding more.
Yeah. But it's like, there's been so many things like that where, I mean, there's a lot of, I'm like, oh my God, this is amazing. This is everything. And then you dig
into it. A lot of false starts. Yeah.
Yeah. So, all right, what's BNI?
Okay, BNI. So let's go to the exact opposite end of the spectrum. The most fucking dumbed down old school thing that I discovered that I didn't know about. So BNI is a business referral network. I don't even know what BNI actually stands for either.
Is a company?
BNI is a company. Go to BNI.com. So these guys, I think, are making about $50 million a year. And what they do is, let's say you start a local chapter. So this is kind of like the Vistage model that both of us are interested in. Like, so this is a little bit different though. So what happens is they have 10,000 chapters and they have 270,000 members. So you can do the math on kind of how much they're making in their membership fees. But the way it works is in a local chapter, there'll be like one, let's say, financial advisor, one plumber, one, you know, whatever the other occupations are that people have. A whole bunch of like kind of self-employed people. And it's a referral network. So it's like, cool, I'm in this chapter. I meet you guys. You're my homie now. So now whenever I know a guy who needs a lawyer, I'm going to refer the lawyer in my circle to any of my customers. I'm a financial advisor. And whenever you're, hey, lawyer, whenever your guys need a financial advisor, you refer them to me. And so it's a referral network for basically tradespeople to swap customers. And super simple idea. Obviously, it drives a lot of value in that if I'm, you know, every business wants more customers. And if this is a trusted way to do it, great. And it also has the kind of benefits of like you meet other people who are kind of in similar buckets and you're like, oh, cool. Like we're kind of brothers in arms, except for you do law and I do financial advising. And then this guy's a mechanic and then that guy's a whatever. Pretty cool. Been around for a while. Hadn't heard of it.
Since 1985.
Yeah.
I'm looking it all up now. Is this the guy who is the chairman of it? He just his photo. He looks like a slick. He looks like a.
So we're looking at a photo. He's got his hands up. He's on stage. He does the thing where he put a keynote speaking thing of his, which is always a tell that this guy's insecure. And then,
he could be a great guy. I mean,
wearing a suit and tie, hair slicked back. So that's why Sam's saying what he's saying. We have to paint the picture so people understand why you would just say that.
Yeah, and I'm not actually saying this guy.
Yeah, nobody knows. We don't know this guy.
I don't know, but so is this a scam? This is so weird to me. The top searches is BNI a pyramid scheme. That's what the top search is. Like if you type in BNI.
Yes, I believe that. And
you do think it's a pyramid scheme?
No, I believe that people would be curious about that because it's organized like a MLM in a way. You become a local chapter owner, then you recruit members in your local network, and then all of you pay dues to the mothership. And like that's, you know, whether it's affiliate or actual, like, you know, MLM, like that's a similar model. And so I understand why people would be skeptical. But I found this really interesting. This is something, a business I had never heard of.
I'm looking at it now. It says they have over 270,000 members. In 2019, members generated $16 billion in revenue through referral business. I just never would have thought that this many people would buy into this. Yeah. You know what I mean? I'm a little flabbergasted. I'm looking at everything I can. I'm flabbergasted. How'd you find this?
I was talking to somebody, so I run these mastermind groups, right? And I was talking to the guys and I was kind of like, yeah, I run three of these groups now. And they're like, oh, it's great. You know, you have so many people signing up. You want to open up more. And I was like, yeah, but I don't know if I want to do this anymore. I kind of am tired of these. This is kind of a lot of work. And then I was like, you know, there's these interesting, like, either I want to scale it up and make this a big deal, or I want to wind it down and not do it at all. Like, I don't want to be in this like little bucket where I'm like doing a few and it's kind of a time suck, but it's not making a shit ton of money. And so one of the guys in that, Ben, he told me about this and I was like, oh, interesting. I never heard of this. And then they were actually all aware of it, which I had never really, because they're all small business owners. So they had been contacted or, you know, offered to join this thing.
Yeah. What I've learned about those. So I've been investigating this, these like groups, they do scale. It is hard work.
Yeah.
It is very hard work.
Yeah, this is your business. It's not like it's like everything. If this is your business, your business is going to be pretty hard work. And this is actually a pretty decent business. I think it is a good, well-designed business. There are many worse businesses than this one or the Vistage YPO model also. And so, but you'd have to make it your business, which I don't personally want to do.
Do you want to talk about one more thing?
Yeah, sure.
Wait, did we talk about the erotic newsletter?
I don't remember. Did we bring this up already?
We did not, no.
Okay, it said, a listener of the podcast launched an erotic newsletter 2 months ago that is currently making $6,000 a month and uses Pornhub as an acquisition channel. I don't know anything about this, but let me tell you guys some background here, which is I've done tests by creating like Audible for erotic novels. And in the process, I learned a few things. One, women are absolutely willing to buy this stuff. Two, erotic and like romance novels is like I believe it's the largest category on Kindle. And it's the most engaged category. And I'm a man, so I think of this differently. But like women, like this is pretty much like porn to women. Like this audio, like for a lot of women, they just loved like these audio books and written texts that describe sex and all these types of. I don't even know how to discuss it, like because it's so foreign to me. But like there's all these subreddits where it's like where they just like write erotic stories, and then there's like Wattpad and all these websites that get hundreds of millions of monthly unique visitors, and all they do is write erotic stories. It's just
right.
It's totally new to me and so interesting.
And Abreu, do you know more about this? Can you tell us more about what he did? So the guy's Latana. He's a cool member of the group. He's done other projects too. He's the one who launched that church tipping app as well, Altar. He seems to be a hustler. What's his story?
Yeah, that's basically it. He had launched the church app. I think it launched, but I'm not sure if he's still working on it. He's got another business, which I think is growing. That's his main thing. And that's like, you can book
influencer thing, right?
Yeah, that seems to be doing well. It's like an influencer booker thing. And then he just did this as like a side thing. He has someone running it. He basically set it up in a few weeks and is using
what is it?
And his customers.
What is it? You sign up and what do you get?
It's like an erotic story, like every week or however.
Have you read any of them, Abreu?
I have not. No, that is the truth.
Dude, do your research.
Yeah,
name of it? What's the name of it?
Yeah, I talked to this kid. What's it called?
You want Hinge Club?
Right, hold on, I gotta go to it now.
Hinge Club. Yeah, like Hinge, like a dating app.
Yes, Hinge Club. It's for it's erotica for Black women specifically.
All right.
Beautiful.
HingeClub.com.
I can't find the URL.
Yeah, neither can I.
We should bring him on for like a 10-minute segment. I want to hear how he did this. I also want to hear about using Pornhub as an acquisition channel, what that's like. I've never done anything like that.
It's hingeclub.substack.com.
Okay. Hingeclub.substack.com.
Okay, one quick idea and then one story. All right, quick idea. Employee onboarding at a company. So every company onboards new employees. So pain point every company has. I've hired somebody. I need to onboard them. Every company kind of bakes their own little process. And there's, you know, not really like a seamless way to do it. It's like, oh, okay, cool. You're going to talk to the IT guy. He's going to get you hooked up with XYZ. Talk to the HR person. They're going to get you hooked up with, you know, ABC. Talk to your manager. They'll tell you about this. Oh, this other thing, you'll learn about it 4 weeks later because we forgot to tell you about it. You should get some swag or like a computer. Like there's all these different systems, right? I think Rippling is trying to do this in one way, but I'm curious if there are other angles to it. Rippling seems a bit like the utility side of things, like the getting set up side on payroll with your IT stuff. What about like the sort of human side of things? So how do you welcome employees? How do they learn about your company culture? Is there like an easy way to do these like kind of company culture, like training, indoctrination, welcome to the cult type of things. I think companies really care about culture. I think they care about like people learning like what it's like to work here, what the origin story is like of the company, all these good things. And there's a lot of like folklore that gets passed down and a lot of like tribal rituals that get done informally. Can you do that formally? Is a kind of a question mark. Can you do Rippling, but for the non-utility stuff?
Is that a question you think that people have, or a problem that people have? Like,
I think so. Because, like, for example, at Twitch, I know that one of the earliest employees, like, there's only a few OGs left now, or, you know, 8-9 years in or whatever. And one of the OGs was putting together like a kind of a little booklet that was like, here's the like history of Twitch, like all the cool, crazy moments that have happened in the company's
history. I do like a, I do that with
you. You do like a welcome thing, right?
Yeah, where I say like, here's like the history.
And that's hard to scale, right? Because it's like you're using the most valuable people's time, which is good. They get FaceTime with the CEO and whatnot. I think small companies deal with that that way. But as you get bigger and bigger, those become less personal and also harder to do every Monday, you know? Because every Monday you're hiring new people as your company grows. Like, I don't know how many people you guys hired this Monday, but like you probably had either, you know, between 0 and 1 employees hired per week, max. Right. And like, but at a bigger company, they're hiring tens of employees or even hundreds of employees per week. And so how do you, get them in? So I think there's a service there. Remember, there's like a welcome week and you go through the boot camp of the company and you like, you get both the utility stuff and the fun stuff, but they're all pretty lame. And as the world goes remote, I wonder, like, can you simplify this to being a link? And can that be a really well-designed page that tells your story? That tells
this is what we've discussed earlier, Sean, of like a high school newspaper for your company.
Right. But that's like with the recent stuff. I'm saying there's just like, it's like, this is more like a drip campaign, right? It's like, everybody needs to go through this sequence of getting this information, and you don't want to be the one retelling that joke manually every Monday.
I know, but if you build this product that we've discussed over and over again, which I think you can do it. Yeah, like what you've just said is you need a drip campaign for a company. That so you need like a media company for it. It's quite, I mean, it is quite fascinating. I understand what you're saying. I don't want to work on this because I think that is kind of boring, but I understand the need and I totally get what you're saying. And I'm bought it.
So, and also a bunch of people, I think 3 different teams have reached out to me since we got excited about that idea and are working on prototypes of it. So I'll show you when somebody has one.
Any of them have cool names?
I don't even know if they have names yet. The thing. They're like, we're working on that thing you said, here's the mockups. And I said, all right, send me a link when you have it, when you have a prototype.
I'm very interested.
Okay, one other last little thing. So, are you a basketball fan? You don't follow the NBA much, do you?
During like the playoffs, I'll pay attention a little bit. Why? Right. Were you talking about the bubble?
So the bubble started. There's something interesting here. So, in general, sports leagues are trying to come back. They're having great difficulties doing so. The NBA is trying like the most robust attempt at this. They're creating like a biological seal, a bubble, basically.
Aren't they like at Disneyland or something?
It's in Disneyland, or Disney World, sorry, in Orlando. And basically, it's like a summer camp for rich NBA athletes. And so,
and they're like complaining that they're like, they put them up in like a Marriott and they're like complaining. They're like, oh my God, this is only one room in this hotel.
They're complaining about the room because at the beginning, when they come in, they have to quarantine for 7 days. And so it's like 7 days not leaving that room. And so anybody, even if you just stay in a hotel room.
Yeah, I would hate that. Ugh, I would retire.
The food that gets delivered, they're showing the food looks like, you know, worse than my middle school lunch somehow. I don't know why they're serving these guys such horrible food. And then they can't have like their side chicks come to the place because it's like it's a bubble. They can't have new people coming in. So like, you know, these guys who are used to being, you know, out there, you know, popping bottles at the club, they can't do that anymore. So all these funny things are coming out. But what I thought was interesting, A, I'm just interested in can sports come back, you know, during COVID, and I'm an NBA fan, so I'm into it. But the second cool thing that happened was a bunch of the players, because there's only like 2 media members in the bubble. And so they're reporting on ESPN. But way more interesting is all the stories and vlogs that are coming out direct from the players inside the bubble telling their story. So there's one guy, this guy named Matthias. I don't know how you say his name. I think it's Matthias Thybul. So he's kind of like a rookie on the 76ers. Not that great of a player, but he's cool. He's an interesting rookie. But he's doing vlogs like Casey Neistat. And so
that's pretty neat.
He started his thing 2 weeks ago. When they entered the bubble, which is like 10 days ago or so, he put up his first vlog. He started his YouTube channel. He's already over 200,000 subscribers. Casey Neistat posted a comment on the first video being like, this is awesome. Well-made video. And like, this guy was like geeking out about Casey Neistat. He's like, dude, I love your videos. Yeah, I'm trying to emulate
your
style.
That's awesome.
And he's like a multimillionaire NBA, you know, athlete. And so I think it's cool what's going on. And these guys are they're showing the food. They're showing what they're, you know, how the COVID testing works every morning. They're showing these little Disney magic bands that buzz in. And if it's green, you can go into this area. If it's red, oh, you got to go get tested again. And like, it reminded me, the reason I'm bringing this up is because a lot of people ask me, oh, how do I get more customers? How do I market my business? I just want growth. Do you have any marketing ideas for me? And this is like the universal marketing idea. And I saw this, Heat and Shaw tweeted this out the other day. He goes, the timeless content marketing idea, show your work. And I was like, that's so fucking true. And that's what these guys are doing. They're just showing their work. They're going about their life as an NBA player, and they're just showing it. And that they're editing it into a good vlog, but like, it just works. And this works for your company too. If you don't know how to market your company, just show how you're building your company. And trust me, that will bring you attention.
Yeah, there's so many different words for this. It could be like document, don't create. There could be show your work. There can be learn, then teach. Right. It's like it's the same thing though. It's same just principle. Like yeah. Do everything out in public.
Right. Ryan Hoover always says work in public. And I used to say that. I like show your work a little better because I remember taking math tests back in the day. And like you could get the wrong answer, but if you showed your work, you'd always get partial credit. And if you got the right answer without showing your work, the teacher would mark it down. And it's sort of the same thing in business. If you're showing your work along the way, even if your business is not successful yet, you will get a big halo effect. If people want to work there. I mean, you guys do this. You guys put out a lot of content. You know, Barstool does this even more. They show the behind the scenes.
I like posted the job listing that we had. I got like 200 applicants in 24 hours.
You've shown your job listing. You've put out your writer's guide for your writers. You've put out like, what else you put out? Have you put up more stuff that you've worked in public?
A little bit. I'm gonna create a newsletter course.
Right. So there's like a whole bunch of things that you can do that are, but there's more that are just like showing the life of
right.
You trying to do what you do.
And it's easy. And
it's easy. It is. It does take time, but it's actually quite fun. And it
well, what I mean honest. Is it's simple.
Right, right. Exactly. It's in your control. And you don't need to look for some other external genius idea. Hey, here's a simple idea that'll work for everybody. And it works for some better than others. So like, for example, it'll work well for you because your customer is also business oriented and a business owner or an aspiring business owner. So you showing how you build your business, it brings you customers. Your customers are directly interested. For others, it's more niche. Like a portion of your audience will care about that and a portion won't. But the portion who cares will like love you. And that's really ultimately what you want to do with marketing is get people to love you.
Yeah, most people are just really bad at creating content. But this stuff definitely helps. Like you just write what you are learning and you post it on Hacker News and you do that 10 times and probably two of them might work.
Right. And we should do that with this podcast. We should be like, cool, how we grew the podcast to 1 million downloads in 6 months. Like that's an easy thing I should be putting out there to work in public, to show our work about how we're building this podcast up. That people would be interested in that I haven't done. So I got to take this lesson for myself as well.
Yeah. Well, let's fucking do it.
Great. I'm going to write a book called 100 Great Questions. And I'm going to write the best questions that have helped me in my life. Either questions for yourself or questions you ask others. 100 great questions. I'm going to commit to writing that book.
That's a great one. 100 great questions. Yeah. Because I feel like you already have like 15.
Yeah. I have a little note sheet on my little, like, because sometimes I'll hear somebody ask a question. I'm like, oh, great question. I'll give you a really simple example. This is not a great life question, but this is a great question. This is like more of a management tip. So probably wouldn't make the book, but I'm going to say it anyways. You know, when you are talking to somebody, and this often happens with engineers, you're talking to an engineer and you're like, all right, when is this going to happen by? And any leader is always asking their team, all right, I want this thing to happen. You want this thing to happen. You say you're doing it. When is it going to happen? And like, you know, the problem is people suck at forecasting and predicting things. And also there's this weird like incentive. Like first, like I'm kind of overbearing when I say shit like this. I get like really, I'm excited, but it sounds aggressive. And so they're like, they don't want to say too long because they know I'll be like, what the fuck? Like, we're planning to do this in 6 months? Like, that's way too long. Also, they don't want to say too short and then not deliver that because they don't want to be seen as somebody who missed it. So they kind of sandbag into like some middle ground. So I've always just like been like, fuck, people suck at predicting. This question is useless to ask, when are we going to have this by? And I was in a meeting the other day, and Dan, who's my manager at my company, now, he's way more experienced than me. He's like kind of the gray-haired guy at our company, super smart and way better at managing people than I ever am. So he asked, so the CEO of Twitch asked this question, when are we going to have this by? And I could see the person shrinking and trying to like go through this. Do I underestimate, overestimate? I have no idea what the real estimate is. And then Dan came in and goes, let me ask you a different question. At what date would you be surprised that this hasn't happened by? And the person like relaxed and they were like, well, you know, I'd be shocked if we didn't have this by Q3 or whatever. And they were able to like answer a different style, like just ask a better question, get a better answer. And so I was like, that's a different way of thinking about this. What
date would you be shocked
if we're sitting here, what date would we be sitting here? Would we be surprised that this hasn't happened by or shocked that it hasn't happened by now? That becomes the upper bound. Okay, cool. Now I know that. And it's like, you know, and then he has another one, which is sort of like, what's the soonest you could expect us to start to see results from this? Like where we would look at it and we would be, you know, we'd be smiles in this meeting because we'd see some tangible results. And that became the lower bound. And I was like, dude, this motherfucker is a smooth operator. Like he knew how to get to the crux of this answer I always want without like the bullshit of the person's psychology getting in the way. So I like that little one.
This is not going to be about an idea, but something similar that people will like. And I'm just going to interview you a little bit, Sean. So I've never worked at a company really. I mean, I've worked at my companies and you've up until recently worked mostly at your companies. But now you're working at Twitch with 2,000 people. You also interact, I imagine, with a lot of Amazon people, which is supposed to be the best of the best. So I have a couple questions. First, is your company, I think, was kind of similar to mine, which was mostly young people who were inexperienced but smart and kind of figuring it out.
Very much so. Yep.
Now you're at a company that does it have a lot more experienced people?
Yes, very much so.
Okay. So what I want to ask is, does that matter that the people are experienced, do you think, or not? Like,
yeah, I don't know if it's experience, but there's a certain level of wisdom that comes over time. And also, I wouldn't say it's everybody, right? I would say everybody is more experienced or just like generally smarter, better resume, better talent than the people that we recruited for the most part. Because we were recruiting these like kind of underdog, jack of all trades, non-specialists who had never done it before, but were hungry and were smart and could learn. And we were taking bets on people. And we were.
But is that good?
That was good for what we had. So now I realize, because at some point I was like, dude, when do these people work? Because my calendar became booked. Every 30 minutes was a meeting. And I was like, so when do I go work? Because I was used to, you know, you probably did this with your company. Less so now, I think. But
We had a meeting today at our all hands. And I go, well, we're going to start. We got to, you guys, let's innovate instead of optimize. And also, like, cancel all meetings and start over. There's way too many meetings.
Right. So I used to do that where I'd have a couple meetings a day, 2-3 max. And then for the most part, I was working on something. I was looking at the data. I was trying to figure out what to do. I was sitting next to my designer and like working on a feature, or sitting next to the marketing guy and working on a campaign, or engineers figuring out what the fuck's going on. And I felt like I was in the work and I felt that that was real. And now I'm like, the schedule is just meeting, 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 meeting. And so when I first got here, I did the normal startup guy thing where you judge a big company. You're like, yeah, these fools, you just sit in meetings all day. Nobody here is doing any real work, blah, blah, blah. And then there's an element of that's true. But what I figured out was, okay, what do you actually need at the top of these companies, right? I mean, this exec team, like the top, like let's say 20 people of this company, that's like 1% of the workforce. And this 1%, their job is basically to be this like two things. One, they have to be the accountable party to everybody. So they need to be like good cop or bad cop, depending on what's needed for their like chain of command. And so even if you didn't do any work, if you're the scary meeting of the day for the next layer of leaders and the next layer of leaders below that, you become a forcing function that helps that whole org work. It's kind of abstract, but that's one job that you have. The other job that you have is basically to call bullshit and redirect when you think that resources are being wasted. And so you sit in meetings all day and you're like a computer. You're like, I feel like I don't use my hands anymore. My brain is just in a vat, and it's in this like vat. And basically I come into the meeting, there's a memo I read, so I'm ingesting all this information, and then I make a decision at the end of it, or I approve a decision at the end of it. That's all I do. I approve or I make a decision. Or sometimes I audit when I'm like, wait, this doesn't make any sense. Why does this have all these holes? And that's the role of an executive, I think, at a big company. And like we try to say it's about all these other things. Like it is about recruiting, sure. It is about strategy, sure. It is about setting up systems, sure. But like fundamentally on a day-to-day basis, I'm a brain in a meeting room, and then I get fed information and I either approve or I make a decision or I audit a decision that's being made. That's all I do.
So do you like that?
No.
And do you think that the people that Twitch needs to run their company, these highly paid, probably very wise older folks,
people with great judgment, whether you're great judgment because you're experienced, great judgment because you're a domain expert, or great judgment because you have awesome intuition on some shit, like whatever. It's a great judgment person. Typically, easiest way to get there is a bunch of experience.
So do you think that those folks actually make the company better, or do you think it would be better if it was just like a bunch of startup-y people like you hired?
Yeah, I think they make it better, but I think they are great with established systems. When you need to innovate, that brain in a vat doesn't work. A company of this size that's doing so much revenue, has so much users, for most of the company is just to make sure the ship keeps growing naturally and reducing risks. I was actually thinking about this the other day. I was sitting in like a 2-hour meeting that was about a topic that was like, there's a whole team called trust and safety. I bet at The Hustle you don't have a trust and safety team, or like a Facebook. I don't even know how many resources now, how many millions of dollars, how many thousands of people are just working on the like abuse, spam, porn, fake news, and like account takeovers, fraud. Like there's just a huge amount of that at any big company, because when you get big, you become a target. And so you have a huge amount of your emphasis is just on that. And that's just making sure the ship doesn't sink. It doesn't make the ship faster. It actually makes it slower. It doesn't make it like go to new destinations. It's just making sure this valuable thing doesn't sink due to all the vectors of possible attack. And I was sitting through these meetings, and I hate those meetings because I'm not good at that. My brain doesn't help there, and I get super impatient. But now sitting there, I recognize like, holy shit, I didn't even know this was a problem that big companies have. If you had said it, I would have agreed, but I didn't understand. I didn't really understand how much time and energy goes into shit like that.
At what point did Twitch become this thing where it no longer required innovation? Maybe like innovate, like saying they no longer innovate. I'm sure they would disagree. So they could be argued. They're like, well, we do innovate, and they're right. So that's maybe not the best word, but basically huge drastic changes kind of is what you're saying.
Yeah. I think the first three to four years were more of the scrappy innovation, hustle, throw shit at the wall. Oh, there's something broken. I don't have time to fix it right now. I gotta work. I'm gonna keep growing this thing, and like, yeah, we'll deal with that later. I think that was the first 3 or 4 years. That's my guess. And we'll bring Emmett on. I gotta bring Emmett on. He's got a shit ton of business ideas too. So I'm gonna.
How will they innovate? Amazon has kind of definitely innovated even after. I mean, Amazon had like 2,000 employees, I think, after 3 years. How do you think that they were able to continue to innovate? And how do you think Twitch will be able to continue doing that?
So I got put on basically the core, like one of the core, like innovation or like big, like new things at Twitch. Because basically Emmett was like, okay, this guy is like good at that. He's a startup guy. He's good at the 0 to 1 phase. Most of our company, the people we hire are not the 0 to 1. They're the 1 to N. They're about growing an existing thing that's working and making it work better. This guy's good at making something that's not working or doesn't even exist today exist or work. And so he put me on that. And basically what he did was he carved out a team, called it a strike team. Other companies call it a tiger team, a SWAT team, or whatever. And so he carved out a strike team. He said, what do you need? Name my resources. He's like, boom, here's your resources. So I have basically a team of 30 something people. And I actually wanted less. He was like, don't you need more? I was like, no, less. In fact, even 30 is way too many. I actually think I need less initially. And so we started smaller. We started smaller than that, but it quickly adds up. And so, he was like, okay, you guys are going to operate over here. You don't have to do these traditional processes. You're going to report directly to me. And you have a clear mission and you have a blank check. And break all the rules. Actually, you're new here. You don't even know the rules. Good. Go. And so that's what he did. And we've made like amazing progress to date because he was able to carve out a system like that. And I think other companies frequently do that. Now, this was in response to like a risk to the company. So companies are good at like, oh shit, there's a risk. Boom, assemble the SWAT team. Facebook always had this thing called lockdown. We'll go into lockdown and nobody leaves till we solve this problem type of thing. And so that's as a risk. Then there's other areas where it's like more opportunistic. It's like, it'd be nice if like, we should be innovating. I think that's harder for big companies. Big companies are pretty good at responding to like existential threats and risks, at least more so than just continued innovation driven by their own motivation,
And Emmett, when Emmett started the company, he was a college kid. And it started as one thing. And then after 6 or 8 years or something, I mean, a while, it evolved into Twitch. How do you think he has done going from being a college kid who's just like creating some stupid thing in his dorm room to now running a massive.
I think he's great, but I didn't know him before. So I only know him. I've only known the guy for a year. And in that year, I'm like, this guy's great. He does all these, you know, I can see he still has the entrepreneurial edge. And the like, in the meetings, he'll be like, cut the bullshit. Like, we need to go fast. And like, why are we not going fast? And then we'll be like, oh, excuse, excuse, excuse. And he's like, okay, cool. Let's kill all those excuses and let's do it. And he has those moments. But there's all the other shit you have to do to run a large company that's managing a P&L and trying to get profitable and is mature. And you have to deal with these trust and safety issues. And like, I know that wasn't his base strengths. Like his strengths are, he's super strategic. He's super smart. He used to be a programmer and now he's not programming. He does strategy stuff, but he's not the product person anymore. And he's got all these people in his company. And so I think he first surrounded himself with other people. So he hired Sarah, who was the CEO of Pandora. She's the CEO of Twitch now. And she's a great operational, like kind of, she can whip an organization into shape. Then he brought in Dan. Dan was at Google. He ran YouTube's engineering and product. And then he was at Nextdoor as the CPO. So now he's the chief product officer essentially of Twitch. And Dan knows how to also run an organization. So what Emmett didn't know, he brought in people to do it. And then he just kind of kept doing the thing he's good at, which I think is the right way to be. And like, you know, I said that thing about a brain in a vat. Like he literally just sits in a meeting room essentially all day and a different team comes in and then they have a memo. His job is to read the memo and respond in a way that like helps the team be better in some way. And this dude, like within 5 minutes, the memo is digested. He's figured out he's found the one inaccuracy of the memo. He'll call that out. And he's found the two like important things of the memo and he'll focus the discussion on that. He does that better than anyone. And I think he does it better than anyone because he's probably been doing that one exercise for 5 years straight. And plus his brain already had like very high horsepower. So it's pretty impressive.
I enjoy talking about this because I think that when people who are listening and me included are building companies, you forget that you can build your own reality and you can kind of make it what you want to make it. And I enjoy hearing about this because sometimes I'm wondering, I'm like, which reality would I enjoy? Right. And so I like hearing about other people's reality.
I also looked at his life now and I was like, I would not want that life. And I thought that's what I wanted, which is really actually important, right? When you realize your dream is it actually a nightmare, not a dream. And it's not that extreme, but like the dream of what if I built a big company like a Twitter or a YouTube or a Twitch, and I was a CEO and we had this really unique, we were the market leader and we had this cool company culture and all this bullshit. When I see what his day-to-day is like, I'm like, okay, I think it'd be cool to build a thing like Twitch, but I wouldn't want to be the CEO of this. I don't want this headache. This headache is not a fun lifestyle for me.
Well, I think people don't realize is that A, it's shockingly boring, and B, you actually have to just do a lot of negative stuff all the time.
Yeah, the amount of time that he's thinking about what is the future of Twitch, what's our strategy, how do we get there, how do we build an awesome culture, is small on the pie chart compared to dealing with headache of the day, headache of the week, headache of the month, and then like recurring headache of the year. And like those are, it's mostly dealing with pain in the asses, either people or problems. But that's what he gets paid the big bucks to do, right? But I realized, whoa, shit, that's not what I would want as my lifestyle. Which is good to know because that's what I was shooting for before. So it's good to see it and be like, oh, swerve.
I love hearing this stuff.
So I did one smart thing and I recommend anyone does this. So I think I mentioned this before, but I asked Emmett, I said, hey, can you send me the earliest pitch decks, memos, meeting notes, anything you got from the early days of Twitch? Just go to your email, sort by earliest, and just forward me anything with an attachment. And he did. He sent me a bunch of stuff. And so I saw the first slide decks when they're pivoting from Justin TV to Twitch, or his user interview notes when he called 100 streamers and was like, hey, how do I get you to switch to Twitch? You're on this other platform today, and how they became the market leader. And just seeing the way and now it's funny because like now everything's so structured. It's 6-page memos formatted in a certain way. Like you have to say, you don't say like growth is really strong. You have to say we grew from X percent to Y percent, which is plus or minus this percent month over month, which is plus or minus our quarterly goal. And that's the format. And if you ever say something like, you know, things are going well, or this is a big risk or whatever, like you need to back everything up in this formatted way. But back then, like his players were like a startup, right? Like it was just, you know,
shoot from the hip.
Yeah. Shoot from the hip. All right. So then I went to this guy, Ethan, who's become kind of a cool little mentor of mine. Ethan is like L10, which is like one of the top levels under Bezos, at Amazon, and he runs the Prime division. And so I asked him, I said, so here's my email to Ethan. I said, AWS Origins, that's the subject line. So I said, were you involved at the birth of AWS? Such an incredible business. I said, was this a high-profile big bet that they knew, oh, this could pay off big, let's bet big? Or was this like some unassuming little project with modest aspirations that happened to become a monster? I said, did this start with one of those six-page memos? Is that memo now framed and hung on the Hall of Fame walls? I've read some articles, but I want to know from the inside what actually went down. And so this is great. And so then he's like, I was around. I wasn't directly involved. And so then he answered question by question. He goes, it started small as far as I know. He goes, there's three little services, you know, SimpleDB, S3, EC2, a database, storage, and compute. It started with a small team of engineers, which is like the Amazon two pizza team. I don't know if you've ever heard that. Like, they want every team to be small enough where you can be fed by two pizzas. And he's like, you know, S3 came out first. It worked. It was, you know, modest fanfare when it launched. But then EC2 came out. It was an instant hit. Hockey stick growth. No looking back. We all realized, holy shit, this is actually going to be pretty big. We started adding services. And then those services we added were just – we just looked at what people were doing on top of EC2 and, oh, they're hacking that together. Let's build a really good service that everyone can use that does exactly that. Or, hey, they're using the service in a way that's in a breaking it. Let's quickly protect the service and make sure it can't break in that way. So he's like, if you think about like a VC portfolio, AWS was three bets. One was we can get our money back with a little bit of profit acquisition exit. Like S3 was like a small win. EC2 was like a unicorn IP that went to IPO, and one was a small loss, which was SimpleDB. But you know how it goes. The unicorn pays for all the other losses that you had, so it ended up working out. How does this match with the public lore, the public story? And then he lastly came, and I came back, and I said, you know, this all kind of is interesting, matches up. I said, how come AWS didn't do payments? You know, it seems like payments is a core infrastructural service. Stripe did that. Stripe was basically AWS payments and built like a $25 billion company. What happened? You guys launched payments early on. Why didn't it work? And he was like, you know, our failure in payments was due to us like wanting to narrowly control them rather than our old playbook, which was give up margin and use that to get to mass adoption. Every payment thing we ever done has flopped. We overthink it always. Stripe was a big win, but we didn't catch it. And then he was looking for the memo to send me, the original memo to send me. And I was like, I love being an internet historian in this way. I don't know if other people like this stuff, but
I love hearing that. Another thing is that I was listening to a venture, Madonna, or I forget, whichever guy gave Bezos their seed money. And apparently he was telling a story when he interviewed him. He was like, Bezos was like, yeah, man, I think this might be $100 million business.
Right.
And I just love hearing those stories like that.
Yeah, and there's people who tell these other folk stories. Like, so for example, and you got to know that a lot of this is bullshit. So Chris Sacca is pretty famous for this. He tells stories. He's like, the greatest entrepreneurs I know, from the first conversations, it's like they could see in the future. They knew. He's like, I remember I bumped into Kevin Systrom from Instagram in a co-working space. And he was telling me, like, you know, he was showing me his little app that nobody had even used it. It was just on his phone. And he's like, yeah, like when we get to 5 million members, we'll do this feature. When we get to 50 million, we'll roll out this feature. And he's like, I remember thinking, 50 million, dude, you're smoking crack. Like nobody even knows what the hell your app is. He's like, but he knew. And so this, like, it becomes a story. He's telling this on CNBC. And then I've heard Peter Thiel tell the story of, like, you know, I was the first investor in Facebook, and Facebook was doing well. And then Yahoo or whoever, I think Yahoo, offered them $1 billion to sell. And Mark came into the board meeting and was like, hey, you know, this shouldn't take long, maybe 5-6 minutes, just a formality. But yeah, we've received this offer. We're obviously not going to take it. And then so Peter Thiel's telling the story to make Zuck seem like this, like, you know, this monster who just kind of always knew, this like this omniscient person who just knew what the future was going to be and was so courageous to just turn it down, no brainer. And, you know, us mere mortals would never do that. We would be like so excited to get a $1 billion offer. But then you hear the real stories behind these things. And apparently, and I'm going to have Josh Ellman come on and confirm this story. But from what I know, Zuck did say no to the initial offer. And then Facebook started doing kind of like, had like kind of a down year. Growth was kind of low. They took a down round. But before they took that, Zuck actually went back and actually agreed to a deal to sell to Yahoo for, I think, $1 billion or $900 million. And it was going to happen. And then like a week later or so, Yahoo came back and tried to renegotiate the deal down to 650 or 750 or something like that. And Zuck was like, all right, fuck this. Like, no, we're not taking that deal. And they went back to independent. But like, let's not forget, he was going to take that deal. And like, same thing with all these other, you know, famous stories of like, oh, you know, Chris Hocker talks about Uber. He's like, Travis Kalanick, he would come to my house in Tahoe, sit in my hot tub, and we'd talk about how we're going to destroy the taxi industry and all this shit. Yeah, but also Travis Kalanick didn't think this was a big enough project to be CEO of, and like recruited a random CEO of Twitter to kind of run his pet project until he realized this thing's going to be big, and then he took over. So like, let's not pretend like these things don't have humble origins and really humble beginnings. And, you know, Zuck was like, you know, there's interviews of him on a college couch being like, why does this have to expand past colleges? It's just a cool college thing. It doesn't have to be more. And like, now he's putting satellites on, you know, above the earth to give people in India internet access so they can use Facebook. Like, these things start humble.
I think that like there are occasions, like I've been reading Henry Ford's book, where it's like there's definitely people like him and Edison who are visionaries, and it's like, oh, everyone in America should have lights. That those people exist, but then there are also people who are described as visionaries, and it originally started out as like, isn't this neat, this little widget I made?
Yeah, Google, they wanted to sell for $1 million. They were happy to take a $1 million offer, and they just didn't get it, so they kept going.
So I love hearing those stories.
Okay, that's all I got. This long episode. Tell us how this was. I think this was maybe a C- episode. Give us a grade. Just throw a letter at us on Twitter. Our Twitter handles will be in the description. Just tweet at us a letter grade, or go on our Facebook group and give us a letter grade. I want to know what you guys thought of this.
I guess we'll find out.
But yeah, hope you enjoy this episode. As always, cool. See ya.